an Impact on Jupiter, with Liz Guzman, Tim O'Brien, Mark Perler and Christina Smith. The Jobcast, September 2012 Extra Edition. Hello and welcome to the Jobcast. Joining me in the studio today are Liz and Mark. Hi guys.
Hello.
Hello.
In the show this time, we have our final NAM interview with Professor Joss Bland Hawthorne. Dr. Tim O'Brien answers your astronomical questions and we round up some odds and ends from the world of astronomy. But first, before all of that, Mark talks to Eddie Blackhurst in this month's Job Bite.
For this month's Job Bite, I'm with Eddie Blackhurst, who's a radio engineer, and I'm actually out at Jodrell Bank in one of the clean rooms, which I have to say I've never been in before. But a lot of rather special stuff goes on in here, doesn't it, Eddie?
Yes, hi Mark. A lot of people probably won't know this, but the room that we're in now, just a few years ago, we built a suite of low-noise amplifiers used for a satellite called Planck. And it's comprised of some of the lowest noise amplifiers that have ever been produced, and is taking some of the finest radio astronomy data at the frequencies that it's designed to work at that have ever been taken.
And the bits were made here?
The
just in this
bits
workshop.
Were all made here, yeah, on site here at Jodrell Bank. The bodies that the amplifiers were made out of were machined in a mechanical workshop based here, and I did all of the assembly of the amplifiers. I did the RF testing, the radio testing, tuning and characterization. The amazing part about these amplifiers is that they're designed to work at 20 Kelvin, so some minus 250 degrees centigrade, and they're actually running at those temperatures out in space. The most important thing about radio astronomy receivers is to keep the noise temperature of the receiver as low as possible, because some of the signals that we're trying to detect effectively are so weak that background noise generated within the receiver itself would swamp those signals out effectively. So the way we do that is physically cooling down the amplifiers in what's known as a dewar, which is effectively like a super fridge, if you like. Actually, producing an amplifier that works at room temperatures, not really that difficult. But to actually get one to work at 20 Kelvin is extremely difficult, because the device parameters, the transistor parameters, change as you cool, and performance characteristics of other components vary as well. When you get an amplifier that's not working properly when it's physically cooled, you then have to come up with a hypothesis as to how to repair it, alter it at room temperature, and then try and cool it again. Well, the other thing with Planck was everything had to be of a flight grade, effectively, so all of the components had to come with qualification. They had to all be certified suitable for flight use. We had to have very well-defined procedures to do assembly, and everything, even the thermal characteristics of the room that we did the assembly in here in the clean room, all had to be fully documented. So it was no mean feat, and testament to the skill of the staff here at Jodrell and at other establishments that were also involved with Planck, is the Planck satellite has now been running for several years and is taking really good data.
Presumably everything had to be small. I mean, I noticed we've got a microscope here, and if you're launching something into space, it's got to be as light as possible, I guess, that consideration as well.
Yes, absolutely. The components that we use are absolutely minute. When I mention a transistor, everyone thinks of a device that's quite large that you can pick up with your fingers and move about. But to us, a microwave transistor measures less than half a millimetre across. You're looking at a device which is about 0.4 millimetres wide, and I have to put gold wires onto these transistors, bond wires we call them, which affect the tuning of the amplifier, and they are actually finer than a strand of human hair, and those are all put on by hand.
Oh wow.
Hence the need for the microscope.
Yes, and a steady hand.
A very, very steady hand. You can't have a bad day when you're putting wires onto these transistors. You've got to be really relaxed and really calm. One of the things that we did to keep the weight down of Planck was we machined the amplifier bodies out of aluminium to keep keep the overall weight down. Typically, we like to use brass because it's easy to machine and it handles quite nicely. We're now currently building a suite of amplifiers or completing a suite of amplifiers for E-Merlin, which are working at C-band. For those who don't know what C-band is, it's 4 to 8 gigahertz.
And that's quite high then for ground-based radio observations.
It's fairly high, but it works well with the E-Merlin network. Methanol is the thing that's observed.
So then the E-Merlin network is the network of telescopes operated from Jodrell Bank, which now it's E because of the optical fibres connecting them. So obviously the improvements are still continuing with the production of these new amplifiers.
Yes, yeah. We're making refinements all the time to try and improve things. But we're getting some very, very good performance. And just shortly from now, I'll fit one of these amplifiers into the test duo that I've located next door in our RF test facility. And overnight tonight, we'll get that cold. We'll get it down to 20 Kelvin physical and test the noise properties.
Right. Well, maybe we should go in there and have a look at how you actually cool these things down then.
Yeah, no problem. Let's have a go.
Okay, so now we're here, we're about to cool one of the amplifiers down. I'm sort of looking at a silvery box. It's about maybe 40 centimetres each side. And then inside it, there's one of the amplifiers, sort of gold brick, a few centimetres across. And it's attached to some wires. So how are we going to cool that down now?
Yes, we've just put one of the amplifiers that we were looking at in the clean room a few minutes ago into our test chamber or test duo. The amplifier is bolted to a metal plate within the duo, and that plate is actually cooled down to 20 Kelvin physical. You can see a variety of different cables inside the duo. We've got bias cable, which is taking the voltages and current required by the amplifier to bias it. We also have RF connectors, which allow us to test the amplifier's RF performance. And the actual duo itself, the way it works is really quite nice. It's effectively like your domestic flask that you would have your coffee in, effectively, but it's coupled with a chiller or a cooling system. So what we do is we feed helium into a thing called a displacer, which is bolted to the bottom of the cryostat, the duo. So we feed gaseous helium in at about 300 pounds per square inch. Within this displacer, we have a piston, which is driven by a motor. And the piston allows the gas in at about 300 pounds per square inch. And as the piston moves up, it reduces that pressure down to about 60 pounds per square inch and returns it to the compressor to be recompressed. And it's that expansion of gas that is used to cool the amplifier down to 20 Kelvin physical.
It's like spraying an aerosol then. It suddenly you expand the volume and it gets colder.
That's pretty much identical to how it works. Another thing that we have to do, though, the inside of the duo has to have all of the air pumped out. And the reason for this is air is quite a good conductor of heat. So if we have any air effectively left in the duo, it will conduct heat into the amplifier from the outside world, and we won't be able to get the device as cold as we want to. The other problem, if we have any air left in the duo, is we will end up with dew initially coating the amplifier as it gets cold, and at some point this will actually freeze, which we don't want, obviously, because if we've got dew on the outside of the amplifier, we have it on the inside, and that could cause damage, so we have to pump the air out as well. This actual duo, out of interest, is the actual duo that we use to test all of the Planck flight amplifiers. So it's done some sterling work in the past, and it's still continuing to do so now.
So right now we've got an amplifier for E-Merlin hooked up to it, but just outside of the duo you've got one of the actual Planck prototype amplifiers, is it?
Yes.
We'll try and describe what it is. I mean, it's a lot lighter, as you were saying, than one of the E-Merlin amplifiers, because it had to be to get on the spacecraft. And you're saying it's made of aluminium, it's sort of gold-coloured, it looks to me a bit like a big Lego brick. It's got some wires sticking out and a bit of circuitry in it. So if we imagine that's going up in the Planck spacecraft, and what they're doing there is observing the cosmic microwave background, and then this has got to amplify those very, very weak signals How is it so small? It's so compact.
Well, obviously, for the flight hardware, we had to manufacture things as compact as possible, because not only is mass an issue, but also size is an issue as well. I mean, the weight of this thing must only weigh 100 grams, or certainly not much more than that, I wouldn't have thought. The thing I always find amazing is the all-up weight of the Ariane 5 that carried Planck weighed some 770 tons at launch. And you look at this amplifier and you think, there's no weight there at all.
There's so much fuel they have to carry, isn't there? So you've got to keep the actual useful components down to as lighter weight as possible.
Yeah, it keeps launch costs down. But interestingly, we're testing an eMerlin amplifier in this Dewar, and that's designed to work from 4 to 8 gigahertz in the C-band. Now, this Planck amplifier here, this pre-production prototype, effectively, is designed to work at 44 gigahertz, which is quite substantially higher in frequency. The actual, if you compare both amplifiers side by side, there's quite a difference in their internal architecture. For example, the circuit boards that carry the microwaves in the Planck amplifier are fitted into channels which are, well, 30,000ths of an inch wide, you know, and all those circuit boards are made by hand, so very steady hand came in.
Yeah.
By comparison, the C-band amplifier that we're about to test, the channel which the circuit board's carrying the microwaves in there, the width of the channel that the circuit board sit in, is probably on the order of getting on towards a centimetre wide. So there's quite a substantial difference in the way they're assembled and the way they're designed, effectively.
Yeah. I should also mention one of the things that you just showed me as we left the workshop was one of the strands of gold that you used to coat the wires. And it was like a little strand of gold hair, very, very fine sort of gold hair.
That's one of the bond wires, is it? Those are actually, the wires that we use are 0.7 thousandths of an inch in diameter, which is actually finer than human hair. But for Planck, the transistors used in the amplifiers there have pads on them which are so small that even those wires were too thick. So we had to use 0.5 thousandths of an inch diameter wire, which is incredibly difficult to work with.
I just think one of the most nerve-wracking things about this must be that, at least with the eMerlin amplifiers, you've got the luxury of being able to take them back out and fix them if they're broken. But these Planck ones, I mean, you never get to touch them again. They've got to work.
It was suggested by one of my superiors that if anything went wrong, I would be issued with a one-way ticket on an Ariane 5. But we won't go any further on that one.
Well, it all seems to be really successful. And actually, it's a really exciting thing to be involved in, because ultimately, it's going to give a better constraint on the variations in the cosmic microwave background. It's going to help people to understand the history of the universe, how much dark energy there might be, all that sort of thing. And these amplifiers are at the heart of it.
I can't wait to see some of those papers, to be quite honest. I mean, the whole team, not just myself, put a considerable amount of effort in. And I think, and I hope, we will be rewarded by some really good data. I look forward to seeing the papers.
Okay, well, maybe for the last thing, I understand this is going to be quite noisy. Should we fire up the cryostat?
Yeah, sure, no problem.
All right, so we're ready to switch on. Let's hear what it sounds like.
Yeah, you ready? I'll just switch the vacuum pump on to take the air out, so you'll hear that starting to run. Here we go. There we go. So the vacuum in the Dewar chamber now is reducing as the air's been sucked out.
Uh-huh.
And the next thing to do now is to turn on the cryogenic pump, or the displacer in this case. So we'll just connect that, and you should hear the chugging sound as the helium's been allowed in.
Oh yeah.
So the chamber, you can hear it.
It's quite a funky rhythm.
Expanding the helium. Yeah. Very therapeutic. So not good to listen too long. I tend to go very sleepy with it. But there we go.
So you hear it winding up now.
You can hear the turbo pump winding up now. That'll drop the vacuum, drop the pressure in the chamber right down, and you know, produce a very good vacuum. And you can see here on this temperature monitor unit that the temperature is starting to go down slowly.
Oh, yeah, there it goes. So we've got it there in Kelvin.
Yes, yeah.
So it's about room temperature at the moment. How long does it take to get right down to 20 Kelvin or so?
This dew, you're looking at probably, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours to get it down to 20 Kelvin physical.
Okay.
So it's not too bad. And once it gets that cold, we can switch the vacuum pump off, close the tap effectively on the dewar to prevent air getting back in. We can switch a vacuum pump off then, and it will maintain its vacuum because of its physical temperature.
And then by minimising the temperature, that reduces the thermal noise as much as you can then.
Yes, it reduces the thermal noise of the amplifier to an absolute minimum. Thermal noise is also known as Johnson noise. And we measure that with this rack of test equipment just immediately in front of you, which is the same test set that we used for doing Plancon.
Right, so all those Planck amplifiers have been tested on this equipment.
Yes.
And now they're doing their job out in space.
Yes, yeah. And the test set's still doing a good job for E-Merlin.
Yes, very, very exciting to think that all the equipment that's now going to be used by Planck to get better constraints on the history of the universe and the content of the universe was all tested here. That's really fantastic to see. Thanks very much for the interview.
Thanks for that, Mark. And in our final NAM interview, Professor Joss Bland Hawthorne told Mark about the interplay between baryonic and dark matter in galaxy formation.
Professor Joss Bland Hawthorne from the University of Sydney has been one of our plenary speakers this week, and he's been talking about the large-scale environment of galaxies. And I understand you're particularly interested in the gas and the baryonic matter and how that's come to be in galaxies.
Yes, that's right. So the universe began with dark matter and what we call baryons. Baryons are just particles like electrons and protons that make up atoms. And the universe began with a certain amount of dark matter, a certain amount of baryons. And over billions of years, the dark matter began to clump into structures. We call those halos, dark matter halos. And then somewhere in this process, the gas began to fall in. And when the gas falls in, it starts to cool and it forms stars. So that's what we end up with today. If you look around today, you see galaxies in all directions. We live in a big galaxy. And our own galaxy is made up of gas that's formed stars. Just so happens that we live around one of those stars. And of course, we're surrounded by a gigantic dark matter halo. So my lecture was about that relationship between dark matter and gas, or more generically, baryons, since the Big Bang. So this is becoming a very exciting topic. We've known about that dark matter exists for 70 or 80 years. We don't actually see dark matter, we just infer its presence through gravity. So for example, if you see something moving around in a circular orbit and there's nothing in the center of that orbit, you infer there must be something holding onto it. And in this case, it would be a black hole or it would be dark matter. So as we look around the universe, we infer the presence of dark matter all over the place. Dark matter's in clusters of galaxies. There's dark matter in groups of galaxies. There's great sheets of dark matter. There's great filaments of dark matter. And we don't, as I say, we don't see it, but what we do have are very sophisticated numerical simulations that show how the universe evolves in the presence of dark matter and how you end up with all the structure that we infer from the universe around us. But what's not clear is the relationship of the gas to that dark matter. The dark matter is 6 times more prevalent, more common by mass throughout the universe, so the dark matter dominates how these things happen. And somehow the gas falls into dark matter, and this starts very early indeed. So even within, say, 100 million years of the Big Bang, remember the universe is almost 14 billion years old, so within the first 100 million years, dark matter began to form these small clumps, and then the gas fell in and formed the first stars. The reason we know that is because as we look to very high redshifts, as we look deep into the universe, we find that the gas, the cold gas that should be there, has been mostly turned into warm gas by radiation. And the only way we can see to do that is by there having been a first generation of stars. We also see that there are metals. Everywhere you look, you see carbon, you see silicon, sulfur in the very high redshift universe. The only way to get those metals is from the centers of stars. Those metals were not produced by the Big Bang. So there must have been an early phase in the universe when dark matter formed clumps, gas fell in, produced these very high mass stars, which then warmed up the early gas to make it relatively invisible to us, so we could see through it, and also produce metals that enriched that gas in the high redshift universe. So we have an inkling of what happened very early on, but what's not at all clear is what happened next. Dark matter carried on clumping together, more and more dark matter would fall together, and dark matter galaxies would become bigger and bigger and bigger. And presumably, as the gravity got stronger and stronger, more and more gas was able to fall into these dark matter halos. But the sequence of events from the Big Bang to the present time is, as far as we can tell, really very complex indeed. And at the moment, we're struggling with computer simulations to get the dark matter right. We think we have a dark matter universe models that look right. We don't know for sure because we can't see dark matter, only infer its presence. But what we are now trying to do is to install gas into these simulations. But gas physics is very complicated, and we're not at all convinced that our simulations of how gas falls into dark matter are correct.
Because the dark matter is just purely gravity.
Yeah, dark matter is purely gravity. It just pulls the gas in. And you need to have the gas fall in, because the gas must fall in to form stars. One thing we're sure of is that you never get stars forming outside of dark matter. You don't get a gas cloud and stars in the middle of it. We've never found one like that ever. The only stars we ever see are associated with gas that fell into dark matter.
So the dark matter is key to the accretion of sufficient mass to then produce stars.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So there's a real mystery there. And rather than just running computer simulations that get more and more sophisticated, another approach is to look out in the universe with bigger and bigger telescopes and learn more about what there is to be found out about the universe, learn more about the gas, learn more about stars in general. But you can also go deep into the universe. You can look back in time. Light has this remarkable property that it carries information. Light is also a constant speed. So if you look nearby in the universe, you learn about things now. But if you look deep into the universe, the light has been traveling so long that, in fact, you're learning about something which happened a very long time ago. So using, say, the Hubble Space Telescope, we can look back in deep space and learn about the early universe. Or even big ground-based telescopes like the Keck Telescope, we can look out into space and look back to the early universe. And we also try to compare what we learn from that with simulations of the early universe. So what my talk was about, really, was about how this may have happened. The sequence of events in which gas would fall into the dark matter and form stars. What's interesting about that in particular is that we know the universe by mass has about 16% of what we would call baryons. And the trouble is we only see a fraction of that. Maybe we only see, of that 16%, maybe we only see a quarter of it. Maybe we only see a tenth of it. Depends who you believe. So the question is, why don't we see the remainder of these baryons? Where are they? They're seemingly invisible throughout the universe, although I might say that people are beginning to claim to find this stuff. And so my talk was about trying to explain the galaxies we see today, at the same time trying to explain why so much of the baryons never fell in and were rendered invisible throughout the universe.
So how do we infer that some of those baryons really are baryons if we can't see them? How do you separate them from the dark matter?
Yes, so in fact it's very difficult, because what we've now realized is these baryons that are missing from galaxies, the vast majority of them in fact, these baryons are at temperatures like 100,000 degrees. And at 100,000 degrees, that gas emits in a part of the spectrum, what's called the extreme ultraviolet, which is extremely difficult to detect directly. In fact, extreme ultraviolet emission, direct emission, is almost impossible, really. What you see is you see the gas in absorption. What that means is if you look towards a distant quasar, you don't look for lines that peak up in the spectrum. You look for lines that are in absorption, where the quasar's light has been, some of the light has been taken away, and you see a dip in the spectrum. And we see lots of these little dips in quasar spectra. We just use the quasar as a background light source coming through the universe. And these little dips tell us about the presence of this warm, invisible gas. So, I mean, we infer it's there, but we don't really see it directly. So the idea is that there's a lot of warm gas around galaxies, not in galaxies, around groups and around clusters of galaxies. And what I raised was the issue of whether this gas is in fact distributed on much larger scales than just around the galaxies that we see, and that this gas has a certain motion. It in fact is streaming towards galaxies in these bizarre thin streams, or filaments we call them. And what's interesting about that is we've never actually seen these streams or filaments, but people do generally believe that's how gas gets into galaxies. But that's purely based on computer models. It's never been seen directly. So part of my talk was devoted to trying to understand why you don't see these filaments so easily today, and in fact what you'd have to do to actually find these filaments. Or in fact that's the wrong picture. Filaments may be not the way, or fingers of gas may be not the way this stuff gets in. It may be in fact that in many cases the gas never got into galaxies, or in some other cases the gas got in and then was ejected.
Is it simply too hot to collapse in?
That's one idea, although people think that if the gas does get hot, it will eventually cool. So you should see gas raining in from a dark halo, sort of a dark halo full of warm, hot gas. It cools and then floods in. But my work has shown over the years that you cannot associate that picture with anything you see today. Like cold clouds around the galaxy, like the high-velocity clouds, these have nothing to do with hot accretion cooling down and giving you rain onto the galaxy. So something else is going on. So my talk focused on those sorts of issues, like where is this gas? Maybe the gas in some cases came in and was ejected as warm gas. In other cases, the gas stayed warm and never got in the first place. And I basically built up a picture of what this is telling us about the way galaxies form. And in time, we'll be able to see if my ideas are correct or not.
So what sort of instrumentation is now being developed or used to try and test this stuff out?
You've asked the right person about this. So I mentioned before that the extreme ultraviolet emission was essentially invisible. Well, I'm working with my team in Australia. We build instruments. And we also work with NASA, with various colleagues. And we've been thinking about a balloon experiment that we could launch next year that would have some special technology, photonic technology, that would allow us to see this extreme ultraviolet emission directly. I mean, there are other people who've tried to do this. I have a very impressive colleague at Caltech called Chris Martin. He has looked at doing this with an experiment he calls Fireball on a balloon, maybe even on a satellite. I'm not sure where he's got with that. But we are thinking about a balloon first and a satellite later. And my group already has a small satellite that's been built and we intend to launch next year. But we will start with a bigger experiment on a balloon that we'll launch with NASA from Australia. And we'll try to detect this ultraviolet emission directly, because you really have to get above the Earth's atmosphere. The Earth's atmosphere absorbs ultraviolet.
But is it also then, even when you get above the Earth's atmosphere, do you find most of it's been extinguished on its way?
That's here? A very good question. So the galaxy itself also absorbs ultraviolet light. But there are, in fact, directions all over the sky where the absorption from the galaxy is low. So we basically look in those windows where we know that the ultraviolet absorption is lower than other places. And it just turns out there happens to be a lot of holes in the medium of the gas of our galaxy where you can see through to the distant universe. So I'm quite confident about that because we have a new approach to detecting ultraviolet emission directly.
I was going to ask because which probably mentioned there was an RAS medal awarded to you related to instrumentation. So presumably it's quite novel what you're doing.
Yeah, so yes, I was awarded, before my plenary talk, I was awarded the Jackson Gwilt Medal for experimental astrophysics. And That medal really recognises effort by myself and by my colleagues, really. To be fair, the medal was given to me, but I have a number of colleagues who have been tremendously helpful over the years in Australia. And what we have done is to explore the use of photonics. Optics is where you shine light through lenses and you reflect off mirrors. Photonics is when you shine light through materials that can bend and flex. One of my colleagues refers to photonics as the science of moulding the flow of light, which I like.
Okay.
Moulding the flow of light. So there's actually a review article that I wrote coming out in Physics Today, this issue, the May issue of 2012, where you can read about this work. So the idea of using photonics to guide light and split up light and process light is not entirely new. Astronomers have used fibers for decades to take light from stars or galaxies and bring them together onto the instrument. But we've gone much, much further than that. You know, we use laser combs, which are frequency combs. We use what are called ring resonators, optical circulators, array waveguides, fiberbrand gratings. There are so many technologies that we're exploring. Vortex coronagraphs. I could just keep going on and on. We've actually invented a device which has had a major impact in experimental physics called a photonic lantern. This is where you take a normal fiber, a multimode fiber, where light can go through it in many different ways. But what it does is convert all that light into single-mode output. And that's, of course, what telecom uses to transmit signals all around the world into TV sets, telephone lines, and so on. So if you want to tap into telecom technology to do light processing, you need to go from multi-mode signal, where light can move around in many different ways, to a single-mode propagation, where light can only move in one direction.
It's all about increasing the sensitivity, then, is it?
It is indeed, yes. Yeah. So we're able to break down multi-mode light into single-mode outputs, and these single-mode outputs feed into conventional telecom devices or devices that I develop in my own lab. So we've taken photonics in astronomy to a new level, and we've also taken photonics in space to a new level, because we have instruments we're building for space and on balloons, which are entirely made up of photonic components. So this field is known as astrophotonics, but others similarly refer to it as space photonics. So it's become a very exciting new field, because it gives us entirely new ways of looking at astronomical instrumentation. So for example, a typical spectrograph today that wants to work at extremely high spectral sampling resolution, these instruments are sort of 6 meters in size or larger. We can reduce that entire instrument down to something which is the size of a shoebox.
Okay.
And this will happen, I think, more and more in the future. So in other words, our instruments now are independent of the telescope or the application. They're just very small boxes. So it sounds too good to be true, and it is. The one thing that we're missing right now are detectors that are specialized for our micro spectrographs, our little spectrographs. And we are now engaged in trying to develop detectors which are specific to our kinds of little instruments. Once those detectors are finished and made, hopefully in a couple of years, then our little boxes will be as powerful as any 6 meter telescope instrument in the world.
Wow. That probably leads right into the next question I was going to ask. Do you see then these being used a lot on the next generation of telescopes, or even the current generation of telescopes?
Yes. Yes, indeed. At the moment, instruments scale with the telescope. So, for example, a 2 meter telescope might have an instrument which measures 1 meter in length. Now, 2 meters means the mirror of the telescope is 2 meters wide. And the instrument might be 1 meter in length. If you go to a 4 meter telescope, its instrument now might be 2 meters in length. If you go to a 10 meter telescope, that instrument now is like 5 meters in length. That's just a very rough scaling at a particular sort of performance. And what I've shown in papers since 2006, 2007, is if you use photonics, the instrument can be always kept small. Size of a shoebox. In fact, one of the papers says, "Shoebox spectrograph, one size fits all," I think is the title of the paper. So now, basically what we've done is to separate how instruments grow from how telescopes grow. Which is very exciting, because it means on the ELTs, the extremely large telescopes, which are going to be 30, 40 meters in diameter at most, you'd expect instruments to be enormous. I don't know, say 20 meters in length, or 10, depends on what you're trying to do. Of course, they'll be less than that, 6 meters or so. But what we've shown is that the same box, the same shoebox concept, should work equally well on a 30-meter telescope. But we are waiting for certain kinds of detectors to be manufactured before we can really pull this off.
Yeah. And although we don't always like to think about the cost, is this something that's going to then ultimately be more cost effective than the very large instruments?
Yes. At the moment, it's not quite as cheap as we'd like. But what we're really hoping is that industry will pick up. So I have patents on some of this stuff, which was supposed to encourage industry to step up and engage us, and that's now begun to happen. We've got sort of Canadian companies, in particular medical companies, that are working with us to make photonic instruments commercially. So if that happens, and it all washes through and everything works out in the way that I anticipate, then the cost should come down enormously. So then, let's say that each shoebox allows 2 or 3 or 4 fibers, maybe 10 fibers, to come into it. And let's say you wanted to have 1,000 fibers on the sky, then you would essentially buy 100 shoeboxes, which would pack together in a very small volume. So that's sort of a modular approach to building instruments, and it could be very inexpensive if industry comes to our aid.
All right, well, some very exciting future prospects there. We're a bit low on photons right now, so maybe we should wrap up the interview there.
Right, the lights have gone out.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks for that, Mark. Now we come to the part of the show where we fit in all those things that we can't fit in anywhere else. The odds are ends. First of all, there has been an apparent impact on Jupiter on September 10th, which is quite exciting because the people who witnessed it, observed it, were amateur astronomers. The first person to note it was Dan Peterson from Wisconsin. He was observing it, and he posted on a forum, and another amateur astronomer, George Hall, picked up on this, that there had been some sort of impact on Jupiter, and looked back over some videos that he'd taken with his telescope, and it showed up in the videos, and these are actually now available online. People aren't sure exactly what's hit the planet, or whether it's going to leave a scar like Shoemaker-Levy comet did. But it's pretty exciting because these were just amateur astronomers out observing, and they witnessed something, and now people are going to be observing the planet, see if there's been any further evidence of it.
They really struck it lucky. It's good to know that some people are looking all the time.
Yeah, because I mean, some of these will happen and we won't know that they'll have happened because people haven't been observing it at the right time.
How often have they been seen to happen? Is this like the first one?
I believe there have been about 4 since 2009 that have visible impacts on Jupiter. So, yeah, I mean, they happen fairly regularly.
That's quite often. It's funny that we don't know about these things before they hit Jupiter, but I guess Jupiter's quite far away. Those objects before they hit are probably quite dim.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't detect them.
And it's nice that Jupiter's there vacuum cleaning all those things up, because it's said that the gravity of Jupiter actually helps to draw in small objects that might otherwise menace the Earth.
Our little protector, rather large protector out there.
Yeah, it's not that little, right? It's our big brother, I think. Awesome. So, well, from a very big planet that protects us to another very small astronomical object that kind of protects us as well is the Moon. But now what I'm going to talk about is a possible lift to the Moon. So when I found this, I was really excited that people are trying to build a lift, literally a lift to the Moon.
That's an elevator for anyone that's in the USA.
Yes, sorry. Okay, and so yeah, it's called the Lunar Space Elevator. But don't get too excited because it might not happen. So I don't keep you hopes up. This whole idea was from Yuri Arsutanov back in the 50s. But this was news at the end of August because apparently they had the first kind of workshop or meeting when they actually went through analyzing how are they going to do it and if it's going to work and how is it going to happen. So, right, how is it going to work is the whole thing. There's a station that you're going to send, and this station has to stay in a geostationary point. And there's two different points that you can put it. It's the Lagrangian point 1 and Lagrangian point 2, which one is on the side of the Earth, between Earth and the Moon, and the other one is on the far side of the Moon. So depending where you put it, this thing is, will stay because, you know, this is the stable point. And then from there, you will release a cable, and that cable will go through the moon, and then you will fix the cable to the moon. And then for this cable to be stable, you have to have another cable, and you have to put a counterweight. Some of the issues with this thing is the counterweight, actually. That has to be quite heavy. And the main issue at the moment is the cable. So the cable has to be really, really strong. And one of the main things at the moment, because they were saying that most of the instruments and most of the technology is ready now, so we can start building it. The only thing that is missing is the very strong cable, which is quite important, right? So to give you an idea how strong, strong the cable has to be. So I mentioned that the Russian person that did this calculation and wanted to put this lift to the moon is called Yuri. So there's a unofficial unit called megajuries. So steel has 0.5 megajuries. So that's the strength of steel. The strongest material that we have available at the moment is called silane, and that has 3.9 megajuries, which is pretty awesome. But apparently the cable that we need to go and build the lift has to be between 30 and 100 megajuries. So that's about an order of magnitude stronger than what we have now. That's probably a tough thing to make. But there has been some possible things that they can use. One of them is carbon nanotubes. They said that could be a good candidate, but at the moment it's quite tough to manufacture it. And another is boron nitride nanotubes. Apparently they offer 70% of the theoretical strength of carbon nanotubes, but they might be easier to manufacture. And they said that these will be built by 2050. But they said that even if it's not built by then, this whole technology and all these very strong cables that they will probably build, they will help all the way on like the process of building this thing, because they could be used for lighter, more fuel efficient automobiles, airplanes, boats, and even a spacecraft.
Yeah, nanotubes are quite a big research topic, aren't they? Sort of very thin but very rigid structures, which could be used in all sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that they wanted to have kind of a space station on the moon is because if you have a station on the moon, then it's not really easy, but it's easier to go to Mars. So that's another point that they wanted to have a station on the moon to go to Mars and then have a station in Mars. So yeah, we're kind of colonizing solar system. But yeah, it'd be quite cool, right, to have a lift to the moon.
Yeah. It's like, something that seems so impossible, but actually,
yeah,
it seems like it's now a serious idea.
Hopefully, it'd be quite cool. It's like, I'm going to go for breakfast to the moon.
How many floors up is that in your elevator? Yeah.
Floor 1,000 and something. No, it'd be like millions, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even know.
I mean, I'm imagining what it would be like. You've got this Lagrangian point L2, which is like a point where the gravity is balanced between the Earth and the Moon.
Yeah.
So this thing would always be between the Earth and the Moon. And because the Moon is always showing the same face to us, that would work.
Yeah.
And then you can't attach it to the Earth because the Earth is spinning at a different rate.
Yeah.
So you have to
Exactly. So you will get to the Lagrangian point, and from there you get a lift.
Easy.
Which, yeah, sounds amazing, right?
So my odd and end is about Galaxy Zoo, which you might have heard of a number of times, perhaps on the Jodcast before. It's a project where anybody can go onto a website called Galaxy Zoo and they can actually classify the shapes and properties of galaxies. And the reason is that surveys have been done of many, many galaxies, and it turns out that people are still better than computers at classifying them, which is useful for astronomers in building up statistics. So more than 1 million images have been classified by people so far in Galaxy Zoo in the last 5 years. And now there's another 250,000 online just waiting for people like you to go and classify them. They come from two surveys. One is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which gives detailed images of galaxies in the local universe. And some of them come from the CANDLE survey, which is part of the Hubble Space Telescope's work. And that looks much further into the universe at galaxies that are seen as they were much, much longer ago. And one of the really interesting things that they've done alongside this is they've recently put a tool on the website, which has actually existed for a while, but now it's on the Galaxy Zoo website for itself, which will take any message that you want to write and it will write it for you in galaxies.
It's pretty cool.
So a galaxy font where every letter is a galaxy and it's a real picture of an actual funny shaped galaxy. Or you can get numbers and even punctuation marks as well as upper and lower case.
I didn't know they'd gone on to punctuation and numbers and stuff. I'd written my name in it and I've seen that. That's pretty cool.
I think so cool. No passage is complete without an exclamation mark at the end. So that's what I tested out. But the amazing thing is the person who made this, Dr. Stephen Bamford, he actually created a computer program to go and look for galaxies that look like letters, which is kind of funny because normally you're using people to do this job. That's the whole point. But here it's like automated. And the result is that he's actually been able to turn up quite a few. So if you go in and put a message, you can click a button and say, show it me again, and it will give you the same message in different galaxies.
That's so, pretty awesome.
Like different galaxy handwriting.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like your message in, not even in the stars, sort of in the galaxies, just in the universe. I mean, some of these are pretty funny shapes. I think some of them may be mergers. You can imagine like S is easy to do with a nice spiral. But things like T, I'm pretty sure are like galaxies smashing together or something like that. But that's just a fun thing to kind of hook you in. And if you like the look of those galaxies, then you can just get classifying them and help that project along.
That's pretty cool. I think I'm going to write my thesis in galaxy font.
I'm sure the examiners will love you for that.
Well, maybe just the title. Just the title. Although my thesis has nothing to do with galaxies. Never mind.
Never mind, it'll be pretty. And now from Citizen Science to Citizen Questions. Here are your questions answered by Dr. Tim O'Brien.
So in this month, we have three questions. The first question from this week is from Nick Sanders. And he asks, I'm interested in matter falling into black holes. It has long been a problem for me to understand how matter ever crosses the event horizon. To an external observer, matter will never cross the event horizon, but just get closer and closer to it. To an observer falling into the black hole, and then he quotes, assuming they survive the spaghettification, which I quite liked, wouldn't the black hole evaporate before they ever close the horizon?
Yeah. So so it's a good question, actually. And I think probably what we should do is just remind people what a black hole is first, quickly. So it's basically an object where the force of gravity is so strong that as you approach it, the force of gravity is stronger and stronger and stronger. You get to a certain point where it's so strong that you couldn't possibly escape from it unless you were able to somehow travel faster than the speed of light. So obviously that's not possible. So basically as you approach a black hole, there's a point or point in space which you cross, which you can never get back out from. That's called the event horizon. What he actually mentions is this point about when we look at, if we were to look at something falling towards a black hole, then there's this effect called gravitational time dilation, which basically means the photons as the photons are coming away from this object as it's falling in, we see, because of this gravitational redshift effect, we see the object slowing down. So from our view, we see this thing getting slower and slower and slower. And actually, it takes an infinite amount of time for an object to reach the event horizon, as seen by an external observer, as seen by us. So yeah, things, as far as we'd be concerned, we wouldn't see them cross the event horizon. Mm-hmm. They sort of slow right down and effectively freeze on the event horizon. As it happens, it's actually impossible for us to see the event horizon because the photons that are coming from that point are gravitationally redshifted to non-existence, effectively. They're stretched out so we could never see it. That effect, that gravitational time dilation effect, is real, first thing to say. I mean, it sounds like it could be just a mad idea, but actually clocks in a strong gravity field run slow. And the way the classic example of this in real life are GPS satellite navigation systems that you might have in your car, because the GPS satellites are orbiting the Earth, they're well much farther away from the Earth than we are, sitting here on its surface. So they're in a weaker gravity field. So clocks, the atomic clocks on board those satellites, run fast because they're in a weaker gravity field. So they actually run faster by about, it's 47 microseconds per day.
Oh, wow.
So if you were to compare a clock here on Earth with the clock on the satellite, they're actually running faster by 47 microseconds every day. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's enough to ruin GPS if we didn't correct for it. So it's a real effect. And yes, so that happens. We see this object slow down as it approaches the event horizon. But from the object's point of view,
yeah,
it goes straight through. So the object doesn't feel itself slow down and freeze on the event horizon. It's only viewed from our perspective.
Yeah.
So the object just goes straight through the event horizon. And actually, then once it's through that point, it inexorably reaches the singularity at the middle, assuming there's one there. So it goes straight into the middle of the black hole and that's it. There's no saving the actual object. So in that sense, it's not a problem. So from that perspective of something falling in, the black hole can't evaporate before you fall in. You will just go straight in. So there's no problem there. And there was a little, you said you liked spaghettification.
Yeah. I quite like that phrase.
You've heard of that, presumably?
I've heard it, yeah.
So this is this idea that people are stretched into spaghetti.
Exactly.
It's basically a tidal effect.
Yeah.
So tides, what we call tidal forces, are basically the difference in the force of gravity across an object.
Yeah.
So for like the Earth and the Moon, it's the difference in the force of gravity from one side of the Moon to the other. One side of the Earth to the other due to the Moon. In the case of spaghettification, it's as you sort of imagine falling in feet first. The force of gravity at your feet from the black hole could be significantly bigger than it is at your head,
yeah,
and that would actually rip you apart. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that if you do the calculations, when that happens depends on the size of the black hole, the mass of the black hole. So in some black holes, it could be that you'd actually get all the way through the event horizon before you get ripped apart.
Okay.
In other black holes, it could actually happen to you before you get near the event horizon. So it does depend.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Brilliant. Perfect. So the second question is from Peter Ellinger. And he says, since obtaining a new telescope, it hardly stopped raining here in Sheffield. I've almost forgotten what the moon and the stars look like. I've got to wondering what other observational techniques could I employ to do some observing while waiting for the clear skies to return. I came up with two options, which I liked advice on, please. So his option one is radar astronomy, and option two is radar imaging. And then he asked, will either of these work when it's raining? And what could I expect to get out of the kit by the way of images?
Yeah. Okay. So I sympathise.
Yeah.
He lives in Sheffield. The weather's not much better over here in Manchester. So, yeah. So radio astronomy in that sense is useful for when it's raining because we can do radio astronomy certainly went through the clouds. Otherwise, you know, Jodrell Bank, for example, wouldn't be here. We'd be in, you know, in some exotic place on the top of a high mountain above the clouds. And actually, in terms of how much it affects it, well, it depends on exactly which bit of the spectrum you're looking at. So at low frequencies, so long wavelengths, so maybe wavelengths of like 20 centimetres, which are ones that we typically observe at, we're okay. We can see through the cloud. As you go to the shorter and shorter wavelengths, or equivalently the higher and higher frequencies, then the water vapour in the atmosphere has more of an effect. So yeah, you can get to a point where the rain kills you off. But sticking to the lower frequencies, the higher, longer wavelengths is helpful there. His options, he mentioned radar imaging. I think the answer to that is no. Definitely not. You can't do radar imaging as an amateur. And the reason is, basically, it's generally illegal to transmit radio waves at any significant power.
Okay.
So, of course, you know, loads of people use the radio spectrum. Our mobile phones transmit radio waves, of course, but they are very strictly regulated that they do it at a certain relatively weak level. And loads of people use the spectrum for other things. Radar, airport radar are quite strong transmitters. The military radar use things. Atmospheric radar, so looking at the weather, So there's all these uses of the spectrum. They're all very strongly regulated. And if you wanted to do anything about transmitting radio waves, you'd have to get a license.
Okay.
You can do. You can get an amateur radio license, a radio ham, they call them. And again, though, you are limited to certain powers. Now, in terms of radar imaging, the equivalent in astronomy would be, say, what's done with, like, the Arecibo telescope. They have a really, really powerful radar. Of course, it's very carefully regulated. Can be dangerous, really, if you're stood in the way of these things. It's microwave radio waves. They're not good for you, so you have to be very careful about how they're used. But they can basically send out these radar waves, radio signals, effectively bounce them off a planet like Venus, Mars, or whatever, and map the surface of the planet by looking at the echoes they receive. But because you're bouncing it off something so far away, the power they need is high. And that's why you can't really do it as an amateur. The closest you can get is moon bounce, it's called. So radio hams, amateur radio people, do the sort of more advanced ones, at least, try out this technique of transmitting a radio signal towards the moon, and they actually catch the echo, they get the bounce off the moon.
Wow.
And that's a, you know, an interesting project to try. Yeah. But yeah, strongly regulated, so don't go building your own radio transmitter, because you'll be, somebody will be coming around knocking on the door. The other option mentions radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And what I would do is I'll point towards, well, there's two good groups of amateurs that do amateur radio astronomy. There's something called SARA, S-A-R-A, the Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, which you'll find on the web. There's also the British Astronomical Association, the BAA, radio astronomy group, who are quite active as well. And there are things you can do. And there's a range of things. They've got ideas for projects on their websites. And it goes all the way from, you know, perhaps even just using a small satellite dish like you have for TV and being able to detect the sun. I mean, you can actually pick up the radio emission from the sun with a little satellite dish. And there's interesting bits of physics you can even do with that in terms of understanding the resolution of a radio telescope, for example. Yeah, in terms of looking at things a bit more distant, there are some quite exciting things you can do with a dish maybe a few metres in diameter, so a bit bigger than you'd stick on the side of your house. But you can get one of those. You can have a receiver which basically does fast sampling, digitisation of the radio signal, and you can actually measure the hydrogen line, the radio emission coming from hydrogen atoms in space. You can actually see the spiral structure in the Milky Way, even with a small radio dish, and what is now relatively cheap electronics, you know, with a PC at the back end. So that's worth looking into. One of the other things you can do is meteor astronomy. So you can do, you can look at, basically what happens is you tune a radio receiver to the frequency of a over-the-horizon TV or radio broadcast. So somebody's producing a TV signal somewhere. You wouldn't be able to see it directly because it's around the world, over the horizon from you. But basically what happens is it goes up through the atmosphere, the signal they're broadcasting, and a meteor comes into the atmosphere. It leaves an ionized trail in the atmosphere, and you get reflection off the trail.
Okay, cool.
So what you then receive is like a little echo, a little burst of this transmission. And so you can actually see meteors even when it's cloudy, or even during the day, you know, when you wouldn't be able to see them visually. So that's a possibility. So loads of ideas on their website. And I think I would just say imaging. You mentioned imaging. Imaging in general is a bit of a challenge in radio astronomy. What you could try is using a single dish and scanning it. So measuring the strength of the signal in a given direction and doing a sort of raster scan across the sky, that would build up an image. If you wanted to do interferometric imaging like we do with, say, Merlin or the VLA or something, that's pretty difficult to do as an amateur, I think, largely because of the way in which you have to combine the signals.
Yeah.
And that requires really accurate timing. But perhaps not impossible, and certainly worth looking into, but that would be, you know, at the extreme end.
Brilliant, cool. The third question is from Phil Thomas. He asks, how do potential exoplanet researchers discriminate between a sunspot on the local star and an orbiting exoplanet?
Yeah, okay, so this is, again, a really good question. This is about finding planets going around other stars, and one of the great techniques that's really probably the best example of which is the Kepler spacecraft at the moment. But there's also some good ground-based work done with WASP or Super WASP, for example. What you do is you look at a star, you measure its brightness, keep measuring its brightness, and look for a dip as a planet that's orbiting that star goes round and passes in between us and the star. It blocks a little bit of the starlight. You see a dip in the brightness. Now, the chances of that happening are low, because most planets probably wouldn't pass directly in front of their stars, for example. So what they actually do is they monitor many, many, many stars. I think in the case of Kepler, it's I think it's about 150,000.
Yeah.
I think maybe more with Super WASP. I have feeling it's more than that. But anyway, look those projects up. So to see that, you have to monitor lots of stars, and then every now and again you'll see one of these dips. And the question was, how do you know it's a planet? How do you know it's not a sunspot on the star? Because a sunspot, obviously, big one, would be less bright than the rest of the star. So you would see the brightness dip as a sunspot sort of came into view. Yeah. And then it would go back up again as the sunspot perhaps went round onto the other side of the star as the star spun round. Well, there's a few ways you can tell the difference. One is that when they look for these dips, they look for several of them. So they're looking for at least three, I think, of these dips separated by an exact period, because the planet would orbit with a very particular period. And so you'd see a dip, and then one dip doesn't tell you much, really. Where you see another dip a little while later, separated by, if it was the Earth, separated by a year. Even that you wouldn't be sure about. Wait another year, you see the third dip, then you go, oh, hang on, there's something. These three dips look very, look very similar. They're separated by this exact period. You're then pretty sure there's a good chance that's a planet, because a sunspot, basically sunspots come and go. You wouldn't get that exact period happening with a given sunspot. Plus, the dip that you see will tend to be much shorter for a planet than it is for a sunspot. So the length of the dip. Now, the reason is, if you think about the sun spins with a period of about a month. So if you imagine a sunspot sort of rotating into view, it's going to pass across the front face of the sun in certainly a week, maybe up to 2 weeks. And then it disappears around the other side for a few weeks. And then if it lasted long enough, it might come round again. But typically they come and go on shorter timescales. But it will be there on the face of the sun for at least a week. It's 2 weeks. So the dip would last for a week or two, whereas the planet dip only lasts for a few hours. And then I think probably the clincher, really, and the way they would, we really get more information about these planet transits, is you've got this planet transit. It's a really good candidate. What you can then do is look at the star with a spectrometer, get a spectrum of the star, and look for these Doppler shifts in the absorption lines of the star that tell you that the star is wobbling. And that wobble is what's caused by the orbiting planet. And so that would be a real clincher for saying that that was a planet. So it is a good question, but there are ways of distinguishing
them. Yeah, cool. Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much, team, and thank you all for sending the questions. And please send us more questions by all the usual routes.
Thanks. Speak to you again next month.
Thanks for that, Tim and Liz. Now, onto the feedback. We've had two pieces of post this time, which is really exciting. First, we've had a postcard from Neil Hickling, who said it's a postcard from Turkey, and he says that he's enjoying hot days and dark night skies there in Turkey. So I'm very jealous about that. And he says he's looking forward to the next podcast. I wish I was in Turkey. And our other postcard has come from our own Jen. And she was at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum and has sent us a shiny postcard with a disclaimer on it telling us that Pluto is no longer a classical planet.
But Pluto is still on there. It's a great postcard, though, because
it's a hologram, right?
Yeah, it's a hologram. So oh, wow. It's got the planets on it, and then you move it and you can get to see their names and symbols alongside it as well.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Thank you, Jen.
It's not cheating anymore because she's actually a listener now as well. It's not like when members of the team just send postcards to each other. And on the email, we've had a very nice message from Jane in Phoenix, Arizona, who says she's a long-time listener and went all the way back to the beginning to get all of the podcasts. And then she said lots of nice things about all the different bits of the show, which we all enjoyed. And she says she's going to send us some post, but not just a postcard, apparently. It's a little bit cryptic, and we're wondering what it is. We're looking forward to it.
Very excited for this post. Also, going back to the beginning is a lot of effort. There are a lot of podcasts to listen to. That's a lot of time. So yeah, my hat comes off to you for listening to all of those.
That's pretty cool, right? You do see the whole evolution of the Jodcast, I guess.
Yeah, right from the very beginning up until what it is now.
Brilliant. So on Facebook, we got a message. It was quite funny, by the way. Miles Hendricks, he was on a trip over the weekend, and he played back the August show for a portion of a very long drive. And apparently he almost swallowed his chewing gum when he heard us mentioned a post that he left on our forum. So he just wanted to thank us for all the interesting space science. And he says, "Jod on."
And thanks for all the forum posts and the tweets, retweets and follow Fridays. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On the forum at forum.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
On Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
On YouTube at youtube.com/jodcast.
On Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can also send us posts, and the address is on the website. So all that's left to say is thanks to Eddie Blackhurst and Joss Bland Hawthorne for the interviews. The editors were Christina Smith, Leo Huckvale, Tim O'Brien and Mark Perver. The producer was Christina Smith. Until next time, Jod on.
Bye. Bye.